You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Well, here we are again. It's winter. We're heading into a new year, and the pandemic is still not over. So first up on the show today, we'll check in with the City and Borough of Juneau for a COVID Q&A. So here with me, we have Robert Barr, Deputy Director for the City and Borough of Juneau. He has overseen the city's COVID response. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Shelley. How are you doing today?
Well, thanks. And also we have Denise Koch, who is the Deputy Director of Engineering and Public Works and also serves on the CBJ COVID response team. Hi, Denise.
Glad to be here.
I'm really glad you're both here with me to answer a few questions. First off, not all the news is bad. Juneau is at a lowered risk level at the moment. Can you say more about where we're at currently? I'm not sure which one of you would be better to answer that question.
Sure, I'll take that one. So right now we're at what we're calling a modified high level of risk. So if you think about our overall community mitigation strategies, we have a handful of levels from minimal to moderate to high and very high. And back in the middle of November, we reduced from high to what we call modified high. And what modified high really means is that we're at the moderate level of risk, except for our community masking strategy, which we've maintained at the high level. Because one of the things that we've really learned over the course of the pandemic, especially over the last year and a half or so, is how effective masks are at preventing the transmission and spread of COVID-19, which is all the more important given the current variant, still the Delta variant that we're struggling with, that is so much more transmissible than previous iterations of the virus.
Right. Masking. So I know there's been a lot. How challenging has it been to enforce compliance with the mask policy?
You know, that's a good question. It is a not an easy thing. And when we think about compliance with the mask mandate that we have in place right now, that really the last thing that we want to do is any kind of formal or official enforcement fine. That's not what we're out to do. Really, our main goal with masking is education and compliance via consent, if you will. We've learned and we just really want to share how effective masking is at preventing transmission. We know we're not going to achieve 100% compliance with masking. I'm over masking too. Like, it is not a pleasant thing to do. None of us want to be doing it. All of us, I think, one of the things that we can get behind is we want the pandemic to be completely behind us and over with. But as Dr. Zink says commonly, we may be done with the virus, but the virus is not done with us, unfortunately. And we know that masking is a really good tool in our toolbox to layer those protections.
Denise, is there anything you would add to that?
I agree with Robert, and I think especially, I know that your listeners can't see us, but we're both wearing glasses, and I know that in the wintertime, you have the extra sort of fogging that happens with the glasses. But I think, you know, ultimately, Juneau is a great community. We're all in this together, and masking is a great tool to help us, you know, get the pandemic in the rearview mirror.
Got it. I do want to talk a little bit more about some of the other mitigation strategies that the city is introducing, but travel for the holidays is ramping up, and I just wanted to check in. Are there any restrictions at all that people need to be aware of before they start heading off in different directions for Christmas and whatnot?
Yeah, you know, the main thing that I would say there is just be cognizant of where you're traveling to, because some places have restrictions in place that you'll want to pay attention to, like needing a test ahead of time within a certain amount of time. And similarly, if you're traveling internationally and coming back into the States, there's a requirement that you have either a PCR or antigen test done within a day of departing to return back to the country. So that's definitely something that people should be aware of right now. There aren't any specific requirements or mitigation measures in place that people need to be aware of for traveling back to Juneau, although we do still offer free complimentary testing at the Juneau airport when you return to town, and very much encourage people to take advantage of that. Also, just one other note on international travel, if you're getting an antigen test for that, it has to be proctored. that's been a question that's come into us quite a bit recently about, you know, what does that mean? How do I get a proctored test? And really, when you're purchasing that test, wherever it is, whether you get it here before you leave the country or outside of the country, you'll just want to look for that service on the test kit, because some antigen tests offering that proctoring service, it's generally done via a smartphone. It's like a video telehealth consult, and some don't. So you want to make sure you're getting the right kind if you're gonna go that route.
Got it. Let's talk vaccines for a moment. I just heard on the news today, and this I don't swear by it or anything, but I did hear it on NPR, that the Omicron variant is, they're seeing breakthrough cases with people who have had the first two doses of Pfizer or and Moderna and one of Johnson & Johnson. But Omicron doesn't seem to be breaking through folks who got the booster. So can you remind me, where are all the places that are available to get a vaccination or a booster?
Sure, I can take that one. You're right, there's some new information today that just came out from Pfizer that indicated that when you get the booster dose for adults who are over the age of 18, it's really effective against the Omicron variant. Some of the information that's come out on the Pfizer vaccine has shown that when you just have the regular two-dose series, that it still provides some protection against Omicron, but you have a lower level of antibodies than what was seen with some of the other versions of the disease. And luckily in Juneau, we have boosters for adults widely available throughout the community. You could get them at public health, you could get them at Search, you could get them at Juneau Urgent Care, Genoa Healthcare. They're widely available at pharmacies throughout the community. And if people need help getting connected to where they can get a vaccine, they could go to juneau.org/vaccine, or they could call our hotline at 586-6000, and you'll be connected with someone who could help connect you to a vaccine appointment. But they're very widely available throughout town.
I was trying to find some information today on where folks might be able to get a booster after hours. Are there any after hours availability for vaccines or for boosters or on the weekends?
There is availability on weekends at various pharmacies. And I know Costco, for example, just jumps to mind. They have Saturday hours. The Public Health Center, I think, they mainly offer their vaccines during business hours. But I think if you needed to get a vaccine on the weekend or after hours, I think there's some wide availability at urgent care and at some of the pharmacies.
Great. Thanks so much for that information. Well, I mean, it is getting kind of hard to talk about COVID without sounding like a broken record. I think most of us know what we need to do, you know, get our vaccines, get our boosters, masks, social distance, and get testing. But we do actually have something new to talk about today, and that's at-home testing. These kits are available through CBJ. So I wanted to ask some questions about that. First of all, what are some of the reasons that the city wants to implement at-home testing?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Shelley. So you know, at-home testing is just another tool in our toolbox to help address the pandemic. And really the biggest reason why we want people to have testing available at home is so that you can get that immediate knowledge about whether or not you're testing positive for COVID or not. You know, just think about the scenario where you wake up one morning and you've got a scratchy throat, and maybe it's weird for you to have a scratchy throat, and maybe it doesn't rise to the level of, like, gosh, I'm going to, you know, take time off of work and go schedule myself for a drive-through visit at the testing center and take time to do that because it's probably just going to go away. You know, that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that we'd like you to take an at-home test for, because it might be COVID. And if it is, it's better for you to know that right away. And these at-home test kits that we're providing, thanks to the state and federal government, they're provided by the feds through the state. They're really good at detecting COVID in people who are experiencing symptoms who may be transmissible. They're not quite as sensitive as a PCR test. So, you know, if you take one of these tests and you're really mildly symptomatic, or you're not symptomatic, but you had a close contact and that's why you took the test, you may wanna follow up with a PCR test just to be sure. But at the same time though, these test kits come with two tests in them. So If that's the scenario and you test negative on the first one, the guidance, the advice that's provided with the test kit is to follow up and take the second one 36 hours later. So they're really just another tool that's available that we think will make a difference. We think will make a difference because they give people that immediate knowledge rather than having to wait a day or more for test results from a lab.
Absolutely. And I'm guessing these are pretty easy to do. Have either of you tried one out? Can you tell us how it works?
I have. I've done one myself, and my wife has as well. And it's really simple. So I like to compare it to an at-home pregnancy test. It's very similar to that, except of course it uses your we'll be specific here. It uses your nasal secretions instead of your urine to detect whether or not you're positive or negative. And really what you do is you open the box. In the box, there is a swab and there is a vial, and then there's the test itself. And you swab your nose, each nostril for about, you know, four to five circles, if you will, in each nostril. You then put that swab into the vial and you let it sit for a minute so that the liquid in the vial can absorb what's on the swab, those nasal secretions. And then you take the swab out, throw it away, and then you drop the test into the vial and you let it sit for 10 minutes. And then you either have one line or two on that test, kind of just like a pregnancy test at the end of those 10 minutes. And it tells you if you're positive or negative.
So one line is negative, two is positive?
That's right.
All right. Well, how can we get a hold of tests, and is there enough to go around right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do still have tests available, and we are getting more every week. So right now, it looks like we've only been doing this for about a week right now. Today is actually 7 days exactly. And so far, it appears that the supply that we're going to get every week is going to be enough. Based on our current burn rate. And burn rate is just how many people have been taking from our pickup locations. So we'll keep paying attention to that and updating folks. But there are right now 5 locations around town where you can get one of these test kits, and we're working on expanding that to 7. Hopefully we'll be able to announce that tomorrow. But the 5 that are currently available are all 3 public libraries, Downtown Valley and Douglas, and then also City Hall downtown at the cash office, and the Diamond Park Aquatic Center in the Valley. And we're the 2 locations that we're working on, I think it's fine to announce it, they know we're doing it, is the Public Health Center on Glacier Highway at 3412 Glacier, and then JPD on Lemon Creek, the headquarters there.
Wow. This seems like it's pretty big news. I think it'll be really useful to help people gather safely over the winter holiday celebrations. But I know that, if you get testing through the city, they report the results. How will at-home testing affect positive case count tracking?
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. So, one of the things that is true about all laboratory-based tests is that any lab that performs COVID tests in the state of Alaska is required as part of their licensure to report that result back to the state, so that the state and localities have good, what we call situational awareness. It's kind of to the state of COVID in the community. That's what enables us to report case counts and to report metrics like our test positivity number, which is how many tests are coming back positive versus the total number of tests that we're performing in the community. We're losing that, frankly, with these at-home COVID tests. People are not required to report the results of those tests because people aren't licensed to do tests, right? That's a fact. That's just part of how laboratory licensing works. We certainly ask folks to report those results to public health, particularly if they're positive. But that's not a requirement. And of course, we won't know the total number of tests that are being performed, the total number of at-home rapid tests, rather, that are being performed in the community. So we'll lose a little bit of integrity in that data that we've been reporting and been getting. We think, though, that the trade-off is worth it, right? We think that the value of people having immediate access to testing in the comfort and convenience of their home outweighs the loss of data integrity that we are going to see as this testing strategy, we think, becomes the dominant testing strategy here in Juneau, but also throughout the country and nation, or state and nation.
Denise, would you like to add anything?
I was just going to add that the test positivity rate that we've been using in the past is just one piece of data that we look at when we're thinking about the community risk levels. So we're also constantly checking in with public health and with the hospital to see how many people are in the hospital or who have come in for monoclonal antibody testing. So there are a variety of data points that we're getting in when we're thinking about the state of COVID in the community.
Got it. Well, I know that at-home tests have been widely used in other places. So it's a little bit new to Juneau, but it is not new overall. And frankly, I'm excited that that's an option now. So as we wrap up today, I know you can't predict the future, but I am curious as to where each of you think we'll be this time next year in 2022.
Oh, I wish I had a crystal ball. I've wished I've had a crystal ball this entire pandemic. You know, it's my hope that, a year is a long way away, but I would love it if we learned within the next couple of weeks even, so forget the year thing, but it would be really phenomenal, and we don't have this information yet, and this is just pure wishful thinking on my part, but I'd really love it if we learned that the Omicron variant results in less severe disease, we've certainly heard that it's been the case in pandemics in the past that viruses can evolve in such a way to become more or less transmissible and more or less severe. And we don't really know much about this new variant yet, but sure would be nice if this proved to be one that was less severe. And if not this one, then maybe the next one. And that's kind of the thing that is at the forefront of my thinking right now on that topic.
Thanks, Robert. Denise, you get the last word.
Just because of the time of year, that question made me think about the ghost of Christmas future. and I know that we all are tired of dealing with COVID. My wish for the new year would be that Omicron is not more severe, as Robert mentioned, that although Juneau is a highly vaccinated community, that we get even more people feeling comfortable being vaccinated, and that we get to use some of these over-the-counter tests in ways that enable us to be safe when we're gathering with people outside of our bubbles, maybe for the holidays, and especially with folks that might be very vulnerable. And I wish everyone a happy holiday.
Thank you both so much, Robert Barr and Denise Koch from the City and Borough of Juneau COVID Response Team. It's great to talk with you both. Thanks for answering all my questions today.
Thanks so much, Shelley.
Hi.
Take care. I'm Shelley Delaney, and my next couple guests are here from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council to talk about an upcoming workshop and some other activities. So joining us now, I have Rochelle Bonet. Hi, Rochelle.
Hello, thanks for having us.
Of course, and Laura Maiko. Hi, Laura.
Hey, thanks, Shelley.
Yeah, Rochelle, let's start with you. Would you please introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about what you do at the JAC?
Sure. My name is Rochelle Bonnet. I am an employee at the Arts Council. My primary responsibility there is doing marketing and media, and I also work directly with Laura on the gallery program.
And Laura, you're next. Would you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, I'm Laura Maiko, and I am the artist program manager, and I work with artists and vendors from anything with the gallery. We have a gallery in both the JAC and Centennial Hall, and then we have lobby shops at both the JAC and Centennial Hall, and then markets.
And you've both worked at the JAC for a little while, but I'm curious as to what your experience has been like working for the JAC through COVID. Was it challenging to stay engaged with the art scene?
I'll say this, I've never met a group of people who are more willing to do whatever they can do to keep the show on the road. We've had to make a lot of changes because of COVID. We've done a lot of online stuff. We've done a lot of like partly in person, partly not in person. Our whole staff is very COVID conscious. But the show must go on. And I think the Jack has really showed that to be true during this time.
Rochelle, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I would echo what Laura said and just say that we have had the opportunity to learn a whole new various types of software. Like, we transitioned to a virtual gallery instead of having our in-person shows. We've started doing a lot of our programming virtually, and we still are kind of doing hybrid programs. And I think that's something that will continue to happen after COVID's over.
Do you feel like public responded pretty well to your to moving things to an online platform, your virtual galleries, your hybrid events?
I think so. I think, you know, to an extent, we've all had to deal with Zoom fatigue, but I think especially at first when people were looking for things to do and looking for ways to stay engaged with the arts, that the public responded very well to our transition.
And are you both back in your offices, back in the Jack?
We are.
We are.
That must feel pretty good. And speaking of being back, we've slowly started to come back together for in-person events, and gallery walk last weekend was a big one. How did that go for you and your team there?
I think it went really well. We're one of the few places right now that are checking vaccination cards and also making people wear masks. I know everybody at gallery walk did a little bit of a different thing depending on what they felt comfortable with. But even if someone isn't vaccinated, they're still able to come and visit the show just on a day that we're not having an active event. So if you're not vaccinated, you still have opportunities to see the art at the Jack. And I think it went really well. Everyone felt really safe. And I think that it, you know, things are coming back. And as numbers go down, hopefully we'll be able to change some guidelines with that too.
All right. So I understand that there is a workshop coming up for the Jack that will be held there, and some other activities as well. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what's on the calendars. Let's start with the workshop. I understand there's been a change of date. So I'm not sure who wants to tell me about that.
I'll talk about it a little bit. So we are going to be having an in-person workshop at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. We were originally planning to offer two nights, but we have just made the decision earlier this afternoon to have one workshop on Thursday, December 16th. It's from 5 to 7 p.m. Tickets are $45, and that includes the cost of supplies. And again, that'll be over at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. We have limited tickets available for this as part of our mitigation plan. Only 20 are available so that everybody can sort of safely socially distance. We're asking folks to wear masks, and we will be asking to see proof of vaccination for anybody that attends the event. We are having a local artist. Her name's Malika Michaela. She's going to be coming in, and she's going to be teaching this workshop using potatoes and other items that you may already have around your house. So she'll be showing people how to block print with potatoes and walking you through the process of creating a positive and negative space, doing patterning, and how to prepare a workspace at home so that you can continue to do block printing experiments.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. And, you know, it's the perfect time for the holidays, but also this is something that you can do year round for any occasion that calls for gift wrap.
I'm sure there's other uses for it too, but that is pretty cool. I'm always wondering how I can make my own cards or gift wrap, or, you know, just the less you have to buy, the better, right?
Absolutely.
Anything else on the Jack calendar that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, on December 18th, we have our in-person event called Stuffed. It is a $25 and less market. It's for all the people that need to get a few more things for the holidays, but they've already, you know, I think by mid-December, everyone's already like tired of spending so much money. So it's a market that's geared towards lower priced items. We have a lot of people who do this because it is such a successful market and they're willing to mark down their stuff a little bit more. So we have Bronze Betty Finery, we got Tide Watcher, we got I'm So Busy AK. I don't know if you know them, but they make these great mason jar koozies. They're amazing. We have Lottie's Eye, Tail Feathers, The Bear House, Pruitt's Products. Everybody here is, it's all handmade. It's all makers. It's all made in Alaska. It's a really, really awesome market.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun and like a lot of great gift ideas there. I'm guessing it's kind of like maybe stocking stuffers is the theme, but I just like the idea of lower priced gifts. That's pretty rad.
Lower price, but also made in Alaska. You know, you can tell people like, oh, I got these earrings for you. And they're, you know, handmade by someone who lives down my street. And I think that's kind of the best part too.
Well,
and it's going to be happening from 10.
We might have lost Laura there. Rochelle, can you recap the events for us or the details of Stuffed for us, please?
Sure. Yeah. Stuffed is scheduled for Saturday the 18th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And that's also going to be over at the Jack in the main hall and probably in the gallery and lobby areas.
Oh, terrific. Well, both the gift wrapping event and Stuffed with locally made lower price gifts, they both sound like terrific ways to prepare for the holidays and DIY and shop local. So thanks both of you for offering those great workshops. Is there anything else that you want to talk about today?
We're open. Come visit us. We're open from, our buildings are open from Tuesday through Friday. And sometimes you'll have to ring the doorbell if it's windy or if you're coming to Centennial Hall, but we're around, we're back.
Oh, great to hear. Laura Maiko and Rochelle Bonet, thank you so much for being on the show with me today. It was great to chat with you.
Thanks, Shelley.
Take care and happy holidays.
You as well.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. My next guest today is John Thill. He's the new director of Juno Public Library. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, well, for starters, would you please introduce yourself? Give us your bio.
All right. Well, you know, I've worked in libraries for I think it's 19 years now. Prior to being here at Juno, I worked for the Meridian Public Library in Idaho. That's a suburb of Boise. My family and I moved up here just a few months ago to take the job here in Juno. And it's been really exciting so far, and I'm really enjoying it living in this new place.
What draws you to working in this field, library services?
Well, it's been, you know, it's like many library people, I fell into it at some point, but I quickly discovered that I really loved it. I think the main thing that makes it so interesting and such a fun position to work in is the variety of things that libraries do is one thing, but also the fact that libraries have a real impact on people's lives. In many cases, we often, you know, help people find something that they really need, whether that be, you know, a way to access health insurance or a piece of information they need to connect with a family member. So that's really what has drawn me to it, is that both the variety and just the way that, you know, we can help people on a day-to-day basis.
So you've been working for libraries almost 20 years, a lot has probably changed from when you started until now. What do you think are some of the most significant and most valuable changes that have happened with public libraries?
Well, I know everyone expects me to say digital materials. That's been a big deal, but I think the most significant change for libraries in the last 20 years, and it has to do with digital materials a little bit, is the focus on communities and being a real important community space, not just a repository for books. And a lot of that has to do with the outgrowth of, you know, making sure that libraries remain relevant to their communities into the future. But the aspect of the community building and providing community space and community programs that libraries do has really been one of the big changes over the last almost 20 years.
I understand that in addition to extensive experience working in libraries, you also have a background in restorative justice. How did you get into that?
Well, honestly, it's an outgrowth of some of the places I worked. When I worked in Idaho, the library there was right across the street from a middle school. And, you know, a lot of our behavior problems we had day to day involved middle schoolers. And I was just finding that, you know, we'd ask them to leave for the day or we might suspend them. And it didn't really solve the problem. They'd come back later, have the same problems. And we were also taking away an important service from somebody that really needed to use it. In many cases, it was a safe space for, a youth that was using the library. And so I started getting interested in restorative practices as a way to kind of find another way to deal with some of these problems, and really found that it was a way to solve things, problems more permanently, more restoratively, I guess, without having to necessarily suspend people or take away their privileges of using the library.
I see. Are there any other ways that restorative justice and library services kind of overlap or have overlap for you in the jobs you've had in the past?
I think the aspect we think about libraries as community spaces, restorative practices really take into account the idea of we all exist in a community and we have to work together to solve some of the problems that come up as, you know, members of a community. And I think that piece really lends itself well to using a lot of the restorative tools in libraries as, you know, a framework for dealing with a number of problems that come up.
So what appealed to you about working for the Juneau Public Library?
Well, I think, like many, I was drawn to Juneau by its natural beauty. It's been so wonderful being up here so far. I've so enjoyed, you know, going on some long hikes and really taking in just everything that Juneau has to offer. And I think that another thing that's really great about Juneau is its support and how much people use our public libraries here. It's clear, especially because we just did some surveying around library services, and we heard so many wonderful positive things from the community about library services and what they enjoy and needs they help fulfill for people in their lives.
So it sounds like you've been enjoying your time in Juneau so far. Can you remind me again how long you've been here?
I've been here since August, so it's been a few months, but, you know, still relatively new. It's still my first winter in Juneau, you know?
Yeah, well, it's been hitting pretty hard. Well, finally, since you work for the library, I was wondering if we can talk books. What are you reading right now?
I just finished a book by Daniel Immerwahr. It's called To Hide an Empire. And I thought that was a really interesting book, and mainly because of its Alaska connections, honestly. It's a book about the United States and its colonial past, mostly focuses on the Philippines, Alaska, and Puerto Rico. And the Alaska portion was really interesting, especially someone who's new to Alaska. But I think for really anyone who might have an interest in Alaska history, it's a great book to check out. Talks a lot about Alaska's road to statehood. And also, really, there's an important part of that book that talks about Native contributions to winning World War II, which is not much talked about in the history books. And so I think that was a really interesting book that I really enjoyed. It's a little on the long side, but it's fascinating because so much of it is history you really haven't heard about much.
I'm curious as if you are reading a hard copy, an e-copy, or an audio copy.
I read a hard copy of that particular book, but I'm an omnivore as far as format goes. I move around from digital to audio to print copies, regularly. Just depends on how I can get it.
Our listeners know that the same is true for me as well. I take all, I devour all the different formats. So, well, thanks so much for talking with me today, John. Is there anything you want to add about something that might be going on in the library or anything I didn't ask you about?
Yeah, absolutely. I got one more thing I want to plug is that Juneau Public Libraries, we are offering antigen test kits right now for free to Juneau residents. So if you come on down to any one of our library locations, you can pick up a couple of those for your household. And the idea is you take two home, you save them for when you need to test, you know, whether you're feeling ill or you're going to go on a trip or you're going to have a family gathering or something like that. It's a great option to kind of feel more safe as far as knowing whether you might be contagious or not. And we're offering those free, thanks to CBJ and the federal government for that. But we just ask that people don't come in if they're symptomatic. You know, the idea is come and pick them up, save them for when you need them.
I'm glad you mentioned that. We were actually just talking with your predecessor, Robert Barr, and he works for CBJ now, and he was talking about the test as well and gave us a bunch of great information and mentioned that the library is one of the places you can pick them up. So thanks for that reminder. And again, it was great meeting with you, John. I hope you'll become a regular guest on the show, and welcome to Juneau and enjoy it here.
Thank you so much.
Take care. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Historians say the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, after statehood, is the second most important legislation for Alaska. It changed the lives of Alaskans both then and now forever. And tomorrow night on 360 TV, a KTOO documentary will air at 8 o'clock p.m. called ANCSA from the Archives, Moments in Time. So joining us now to tell us about the program, we have Rhonda McBride, host and producer of this show, and also one of the producers for tomorrow night's program. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi there. Boy, it's so much fun to actually be talking with you on the radio because we see each other and we communicate by email all the time. And we never actually are on the radio together. This is kind of fun.
I know. And we were just talking about how often is it that you get to be interviewed, right? Instead of being the one asking the questions, now you get to be the one answering them.
Yeah, that is kind of a strange turn on things. But I do want to say thank you very much for and everyone else in the arts team for taking up the slack for me while I could work on this project. And my co-producer in this is Will Mader, who he oversees Gavel to Gavel, 360 TV's coverage of the legislature, but he's also a very talented producer, and I like to call him the Ken Burns of Alaska. He's a master at historical footage, and we also had another partner in our project, another co-producer, Kevin Tripp, who is the director of the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association, which is for short, AMIPA, but they are a film archives in Anchorage. And so they, along with UAF, have the biggest film collections and video collections. It's like traveling back in time when you look at this stuff.
Yeah. Yes, and I know that you and Will have been having a lot of fun putting all this together, and it's great that there is so much footage, so much archival footage to draw from, but I know it's been a lot of work for both of you as well. So I'm glad that that you've been able to produce such great both radio shows and TV shows, including this documentary. So let's back up a little bit. Tell me about some of the footage that we'll see and why is it important?
Well, this one main piece of footage that about an hour of the show is built around was shot by a name really familiar, I'm sure, to people here in Juneau, Lowell Thomas Jr. He was elected lieutenant governor and served under Governor Jay Hammond. And his father was a famous broadcaster, Lowell Thomas Sr. He was, you know, a star of a lot of travel shows and things like that for the network. But Lowell Thomas Jr. came to Alaska and made a career out of filming things. And most of them are things like flying, you know, to the mountains, or doing economic development type of programs. But what was really interesting is not long after he passed, his family brought several hundred films of his to the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association. And, you know, they're all that kind of stuff, labeled travel, you know, flying to the mountains or whatever. But there was this one little box, tiny little box, and it was labeled ANCSA. And so, of course, that kind of film is fragile, so it had to be sent out of state, and it was developed, and it turned out to be footage of a 1968 hearing in February where a draft bill of ANCSA was reviewed. It involved 3 days of testimony, and although there is only 6 minutes of black and white film on this, it was transcribed, so there's 500 pages of testimony. And what we did is we kind of used this film as a vehicle to talk about ANCSA. So if you haven't, you know, really followed what's going on with ANCSA and it just kind of swirls in your head, I think that this project will help you understand what happened, because we use the testimony, we use the film, and we have actors, so to speak. Not quite actors, but people who read the testimony to us, very skilled readers. We have our own Aaron Tripp, who does the female Native voices who testify. We have Jake Wade, who channeled Byron Malott, Willie Hensley, wow. Emil Nadi.
Wow.
And then, of course, we have Steve Heimel, who many of you may know from the Alaska Public Radio Network, and he channeled the opponents of ANCSA and Wally Hickel. So anyway, I have pulled a little clip of this, and one of the things was in this hearing is that Hickel testified. He was kind of like the main marquee testifier, and you could tell from the way the film was shot that Lowell Thomas Jr. was waiting for him to show up and set it up as he came into the room, sat down. And so we talk with historians Steve Haycock and Paul Ontagook about Hickel, among many things that we talked about that happened at that hearing. So anyway, let's listen to a little bit of that.
Here we go.
That's 1968. 68 was a big year. 68 was the year that Wally Hickel, as governor, agreed to establish a Native Claims Task Force, which was made up of Native and non-Native members, which Willie Hensley chaired, and made the first proposals for how are we going to solve this conundrum that we've got here that was brought about by three things, really. First, that the state wants to take land. Second, that the Natives, by the Statehood Act and by anything moral, are arguing, no, you can't take that, that's our land. And then the blowtorch put on that problem by that conflict or challenge by the discovery of oil at Prudhoe Bay. So 68 was a huge year.
Governor Wally Hickel was a fierce protector of land awarded to Alaska at statehood. Land Alaska Natives had convinced Interior Secretary Stuart Udall to lock up. After Hickel failed to reverse the land freeze, he changed course and aligned with Alaska Natives. On the first day of the hearings, Hickel headlined the news coverage. The big question, where was the governor headed with land claims?
I think the Native people have a justification in putting on the land freeze as a means to implement a start to get this thing settled. But I would hope there would be some way that we could get together to where this land freeze could be lifted, because we are all Alaskans, Native and un-Native Alaska.
By the time this hearing was held, Hickel had already accepted his task force's recommendation for Alaska Natives to retain title to about 11% of Alaska's total land mass. He also favored cash in lieu of more land, and recast the federal government as the real villain.
The federal government has, for far too long, ignored this vast land of such overwhelming potential.
Paul, what was Wally Hickel's position on ANCSA, and why was it significant at that time?
Well, it's significant because he's governor. Yeah. So he's representing a kind of pioneer Alaska perspective, that it's all resources that can be taken and made useful, and that we need to modernize the Alaskan economy. It's just this theme that's almost as though the Chamber of Commerce is running the whole state of Alaska.
So would he have been perceived as friend or foe to the Alaska Native community in that hearing?
Well, he was probably best known by Alaska Natives for his statewide radio broadcast that he had done earlier. And, you know, the crux of it being, just because somebody's grandfather chases a moose across some land doesn't mean that those people own it.
If you're just joining me, this is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and here with me is Rhonda McBride, one of the producers for ANCSA from the archives and Moments in Time. We were just listening to a clip there. Rhonda, you mentioned that the footage that used for this documentary was kind of found, tucked away in a box, probably forgotten, very fragile. What kind of shape was it in?
Well, they had to send it out to the lower 48 because you never know with film like that, and to a special lab. And initially, the lab did scans on it to see what was on it. And I know that Kevin Tripp was amazed to go, oh, my God, there's well-known people on that. Governor Hickel, Willie Hensley, Emil Nadi, Byron Malott. You know, some of the main leaders in the land claims movement. And, of course, Byron Malott is gone now. But Willie Hensley and Emil Nadi are still alive. And I showed the footage to Emil Nadi, and he could name all the people in the room and tell me about them. But anyway, as it turned out, that film was put in a box and never opened. So it was in remarkably good condition because it was never opened. And it's just 6 minutes with no sound on it. But again, just looking at it, seeing the people in the room and seeing the people, some of the people who testified, it takes you to the room. It takes you to the time. It's remarkable.
That's very lucky, and lucky that there's transcripts as well, so we can kind of put the pieces together. And yeah, go ahead.
You know what's kind of funny is in the film, you can see these big beast-looking recorders. they're just huge. And you see these microphones. And apparently what they did is they recorded these hearings to transcribe them, and that we never could find. Kevin Tripp did a search to see if he could find the original audio. But what they did then is they would transcribe them and then reuse the reels. it was maddening seeing these big recorders there and not having any sound.
So this documentary, it's actually part of a larger project. Can you tell us about how it fits in with what else you've been doing?
Well, part of it is the Alaska Native Media Group and one of its primary movers and shakers, Irene Rowan, wanted to put together a film festival. Normally she does panels on ANCSA, but with COVID, they couldn't do any panels. And so they have had panels, public panels on ANCSA at the 30-year, 40-year mark, 25-year mark, various ones. And luckily those have been recorded. So what Irene Rowan did is help us put together 7 nights of broadcasts that look back at some of the documentaries that Nellie Moore did. She's one of the pioneering Native journalists in Alaska. And also just these great panel discussions, some of them that Nellie hosted, others like one we're going to see tomorrow night, Tommy Richards, who was one of the original reporters in the Tundra Times newspaper. He moderated one of the panels, so we're going to see excerpts of that tomorrow night of a panel he moderated. But these are just great snapshots in time. And one of my favorite things about this project is a little montage, and you'll see it tomorrow night that Will Mader put together. Is there are little clips of Willie Hensley and Emil Nadi over the years, starting at the beginning, and you know, you just see, you hear Willie say something and then say another thing and another thing, and it's like every 10 years, you know, we're getting a different look at these guys, and you go, oh my goodness. Because Willie Hensley, when he was at this hearing in 1968, was just 26 years old, just 26. And what he did and others in that movement, many young people, changed the world, certainly changed Alaska. You know, and it was a landmark piece of legislation, a landmark victory, though not perfect, for Alaska Natives, Indigenous peoples. And it's just such an interesting insight to I think that's the big story here, is that young people can change the world. They can do a lot, and we underestimate them.
It's great to revisit the importance of ANCSA and help folks who don't understand it come to understand how big of a deal it was 50 years later. Rhonda, we're out of time. Thanks so much for joining me today.